Blog Talk Radio.
In reality, I am Super Chicken.
All righty. Welcome to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by Matapro, providing the best quality products that your animals deserve at a value you can appreciate. Matapro, nurturing life. Andy Schneider, the Chicken Whisperer, is taking a few days of very well-deserved vacation, and he will be back with us Monday, August 15th. I'm Pat Foreman. I'm an avid sustainable agricultural advocate and the author of City Chicks and the co-author of Chicken Tractor, Day-Range Poultry, Backyard Market Gardening, and a couple others. My guest co-host today is Jesse Paul of Bidbird, BIDBIRD.com. And today is Thursday, August 11th, 2011. And we would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon to Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio talk show that is broadcast around the world. This radio show is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, gardening, urban farming, emergency preparedness, and living a self-sufficient and healthy lifestyle. You can follow the Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer radio show 24 hours a day at our website. That's chickenwhisperer.com, chickenwhisperer.com. And from there, you can follow us on Twitter, become a fan on Facebook, visit our blog, sign up for the monthly newsletter, The Chicken Scratch, and get all kinds of great chicken gear. If you're listening live today on Blog Talk Radio, we invite you to join us in the chat room that is going on right now. It's filling up like crazy right now. You can talk with other Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer fans and other chicken owners from around the country and even across the world. You can also ask any questions that you might have for our special guests when we have them on. And today, our special guest is Richard Frudenberger, editor and technical writer for Back Home Magazine. He would be talking to us about putting fish by, in other words, keeping fish and storing fish. Now, to join the live chat room, just log on to Blog Talk Radio, click register, and that can get you your own fun and creative screen name, and you can start chatting along right away with the rest of the chat room chickeneers. It is that easy. We also invite you to mark this radio show as a favorite and request to be on our friends list while you're there at Blog Talk Radio. We hope you'll take a moment just to do this today. And again, thank you all so much for tuning in to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by Manapro.
If you have experienced the disappointment of broken or weak eggshells, try Manapro's Oyster Shell. Adding oyster shell to your flock's feeding program helps provide the calcium they need for strong eggshells. So don't let those beautiful eggs go to waste. Try Manapro's Oyster Shell for your pullets and layers.
When you need an incubator, think Brensea, the incubation specialist. Brensea has been a world-leading manufacturer of incubators for over 30 years. Incubators from 7 to 380 eggs with high-quality electronic and digital controls, including precise humidity control and programmable egg turning, all at surprisingly affordable prices. Visit them online at Brensea.com. Brensea spelled B-R-I-N-S-E-A. That's Brensea.com or call 1-888-667-7009. Enter the coupon code WHISPER at checkout and save 10% on their incubators, brooders, egg handlers, and other incubation accessories. When you need an incubator, think Brensea, technology you can trust. Critter-Cages.com is your one-stop shop for all your critters' housing needs. They stock a wide selection of supplies and equipment for rabbits, guinea pigs, hamsters, mice, rats, ferrets, chinchillas, chickens, and other small critters. Their chicken selection includes chicken barns, chicken coops, and chicken yards from top manufacturers. Your critters will love their selection of quality products, and you'll love their low prices. Visit them online at critter-cages.com. That's critter-cages.com.
First State Vet Supply is your one-stop shop to keep your birds healthy and happy. They have a wide selection of medications, vaccines, vitamins, wormers, and much more. Every product comes with specific directions and doses for your small backyard flock. Have questions about a sick or injured chicken? Take advantage of First State Vet Supply's Ask the Chicken Doctor program. For just $25, you can have a personal phone consultation with Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor. The consultation fee is waived if you purchase a product from First State Vet Supply. Visit them online at firststatevetsupply.com. That's firststatevetsupply.com.
Looking for an all-natural way to keep your flock healthy from intestinal parasites? Tired of wasting all those eggs due to a long withdrawal period? The answer is Vermex. With no artificial chemicals, Vermex has been a huge success for many species, offering a completely natural way to address intestinal hygiene control and improve general health. Check out the online store at www.vermexusa.com. VermexUSA.com. To see what products you need to keep your animals healthy. Vermex, natural control of intestinal parasites.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
All right. Welcome back to the Chicken Whisperer Backyard Poultry and Sustainable Lifestyles Talk Show. It is now time to bring a very special guest host, the one and the only of BID, B-I-D, Bird, B-I-R-D, Jesse Paul. Jesse.
Ta-da. Good afternoon, Pat.
Ta-da. Welcome, Jesse. So glad you can join us today.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always my pleasure. Looking forward to Andy coming back, though. Boy, I know I miss him, and I'm sure many others do, too. He just there's no substitute for Andy, that's for sure. We love him.
No, he's such a presence. There's always such a presence with Andy. I really miss him. It's been a long week,
it seems.
Yeah, I've
enjoyed
it. Had a lot of fun. But, huh?
It's actually been like 2 weeks.
Yes, yeah, it has. I think I'll go on vacation for a while.
Yes.
Great, yes. I mean, I was just looking back over the sketch. It's like a rich chocolate fudge. We've had so many interesting discussions. I mean, all the whole GI track with Peter Brown, we've had, oh my gosh, it's just been phenomenal. Arlena, I mean, it just doesn't stop. And my notebook here with the Chicken Whisper Talk Show notes, it's just about full. It's got over 100 pages in it, and I'm just going to have to get a new one here pretty soon. So it's an educational show. That's our main purpose.
You know,
so Jesse,
you and
how you doing today? What's new?
You and Andy should get together, compile a book from all the notes from all the shows you kept. You know,
all
the shows you had. Yeah. I mean, there's so much information, that good information that's on the show. That'd be a good idea.
There truly is. And I go back to re-listen to some of the parts that I really want to, as you'd say, grok, I guess. Remember Stranger to Strangeland? The ones that I really want to understand, I'll go back and re-listen to them. Got one with Frank Reese. Oh, my gosh, that was just a dynamite show. Just amazing information with Frank about how the chicken genetics changes the meat and how we, you know, gets high in the omega-6s, the wrong kind of fatty acids. That was really a phenomenal show. Great,
you know,
great.
Mark Sack, he's the one who's been selling the chocolate Orpingtons on Bid Bird, of course, chocolate only being the feather color has nothing to do really with the bird itself. But he says, he says the Orpingtons that he raised, he asked me, he says, have you ever eaten one? I said, an Orpington? I said, no. He goes, most delicious bird you'd ever had. It's a lot better than the store-bought stuff. So, you know, I know there's probably listeners of the show that number one, that the birds are their pets, but I'm sure there's others out there who also use it as a food source, and it'd be interesting to hear what they say. But I've heard from anybody who butchers their own birds that the quality and taste of the meat is tenfold of that what you get at your supermarket.
Oh, of course. But Jesse, realistically now, how is anyone going to eat a chocolate Orpington? I mean, they're selling for like $500.
Yes,
that
I know.
That would be a pretty expensive meal.
Oh, my goodness, that, yes.
The ones you have on Bid Bird right now, they're $485 for one.
Yeah. I know it. Yeah, so maybe not the chocolate ones, but just in general, you know, just a kind of a, like a free-range type of bird that you've raised yourself. I mean, we've never done it. I'd be interested to see what people say about the quality of the meat, though. I'm actually kind of curious, but it's kind of hard to do it when you're raising them yourselves, and we're kind of,
yeah,
we understand that they're food source, but they're also my kids' pets. So it's,
yes,
you know, I wouldn't want to.
Well, now we've got the chocolate.
Go ahead.
We've got the chocolate bantams there, Jesse, and then you've got lemon cuckoos on your website too. Do they have a lemon taste, and do the chocolate ones taste a little chocolatey, or is this just the feather color?
It's just the feather color. Really, I mean, what it is, it's wonderful for selling them. I mean, because what you have is really a buff bird with barring, and you have a brown bird. But, you know, if you were to say, I've got some brown Orpingtons, people go, really, who cares? But you put a nice name on it, like chocolate or lavender or lemon cuckoo, and people go, wow, you know.
Yeah.
But really.
Well, and then there's a cinnamon Spanish golden pheasant. I mean, cinnamon Spanish golden pheasant on your website. Only $120.
Yes, that's actually inexpensive because you don't raise them like chickens. There's not as many. But have you seen a lot of these pheasants? They are just fantastic.
They are. Yeah, they really are.
I mean, I've seen a bunch of them we've had the opportunity to go and visit different people's farms, but I've seen very many pheasants and peafowl and everything else, and they are extraordinary. So, yeah, pheasants is a whole different deal, but wonderful to watch.
They are. I'm for a while, at least for now, I'm going to stick with the chickens. We did turkeys and we did pheasants and we did quail, and there's just, for me though, nothing like a chicken and guinea hens. But my chickens rule; they're the best.
Guinea hens! Yes, the alarm clock of or the warning call. Yes, they are easy to watch.
They're out of control, really.
Aren't they?
God.
But they're so much fun, you know. They got the neatest little sounds and stuff, and but like I said, they're also great alarms. They'll let you know if something's in the yard that shouldn't be. So,
even if something is not in the yard, they will let you know. they'd sit on the roost at night, just blah, 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 for no reason that I could tell. I mean, it was after dark, even they're just going off. It was like,
yeah,
gee, yeah.
Well. I know of a certain someone and a certain story that someone was complaining about this one lone rooster they had that would crow a couple of times a day. Of course, you know, when you have more roosters, they feed off of each other, so to speak, and they don't stop crowing. But just one, not too bad. But anyways, the neighbor was complaining about it. Well, wouldn't you know that they brought in a couple of peafowl. So we'll see what happens with that story when the peafowl get older. You thought their rooster was loud. Oh, my goodness. They're like a dinosaur sound that you could hear from 10 miles away.
Oh, they are. I mean, you think someone's being drawn and quartered sometimes. They're just,
yes.
It's scary. It's a scary sound.
Especially
yeah, no
at night when they're up on roof, yes. But nonetheless, peafowl are beautiful as well. But anyway.
Yep. So many birds are so gorgeous. Well, Jesse, now you're not going to be able to be with us tomorrow, unfortunately, as our guest co-host. What you got planned for the weekend?
Oh, Probably as little as possible. We're just, you know, we've got four kids here, so they keep us busy. I'll spend time with them. And as usual, there's always chores to be done around the house and pressure washing and everything else. And we're supposed to have a decent weekend as far as weather goes. You said that it's been hot up there. We've had nothing but rain the last 4 days, so it'd be nice to actually get out and cut the grass that's now knee-high from only a week's time. So.
Oh, yeah.
That would be it for
yeah.
us. Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. Oh, boy. Well, that's one advantage of being so dry is you don't have to mow. That's a big
yeah.
advantage.
Yeah. Well, that and we're getting ready because this we also do debris removal for hurricane and other storms, and it looks like a couple coming our way maybe, so we got to keep our eye open for that too down here. But that's all that's going on
yeah.
down here. What about you? You got any plans for the weekend?
Well, I do. Yeah, I think I'm going to go over to Monticello this weekend, Jefferson's home, and I've got some friends over in Charlottesville that I'd like to see. So that's kind of up there. But one of the things I just found out, kind of is I've been invited to do a 5-week book tour in California on the West Coast.
Wow!
So that'll be coming up mid-November through December, and I'm just so tickled about that. I was thinking, gosh, I'd love to get out to California and do some workshops and just kind of maybe get some sales going out there, and it just came right out of the blue. It's through the Permaculture Guild out there. So they've got apparently groups all up and down California that I'll have the opportunity and the honor of speaking to. How about that? I mean, I'm just thrilled, absolutely thrilled.
Well, you should yeah. be. It sounds like it'll be fun.
But, oh, yeah.
You know,
5 weeks,
I've
that's
always,
a long time to be gone, but I can do it.
Oh, yeah. It'll be fun. You know, I've always said that if you're not in the chat room here, you're missing half of the show. And it's funny kind of jumping back a little bit to PFAL. I see that OSU man in the chat room at Blog Talk Radio, he says his dad's PFAL ranged, they were free range, and they would jump up on the neighbor's roof and scream down the neighbor's chimney. So
oh, God.
Yes.
I can't imagine that.
Yes, you're sitting in your house and a PFAL is just, I mean, they're so loud. So imagine the echo going down a chimney. So that is funny. I can see that. As a matter of fact, there was one that used to try to court my mother-in-law. Used to dance around her and stuff for months on end. You know, there was no other peahen around, so he took a fancy to my mother-in-law. Go figure. But anyways, better him than me, I guess.
You would really think your house was being invaded. Huh. Your house was being invaded, or a poultrygeist. You know, would be coming down
the
chimney.
Oh my goodness!
If you heard that peahen. You know that'd be an evil spirit. Oh, gosh.
Yes.
That's scary.
Well, something. But that is funny. Thanks for sharing that with us, OSU, because that kind of made me laugh. I can just imagine a nice quiet afternoon or something on a Saturday, and you're trying to take a nap. Could you imagine trying to take a Sunday nap or something, and all of a sudden you hear that down your chimney? So, anyways, join the chat room.
No,
like I said, plenty going on in there.
Yes, always. Almost always. Yes. Okay, well, it's time for Chickens in the News. And Chickens in the News is brought to us by Meyer Hatchery. And we'll take a break and be right back with our Chickens in the News. Hold on.
Since 1985, Meyer Hatchery in Polk, Ohio has been a family-owned and operated business. Meyer Hatchery is a year-round hatchery that offers over 160 breeds of poultry, including chickens, ducks, geese, turkeys, guineas, peafowl, and game birds, plus a full line of feed and supplies. Just need a few baby chicks? No problem. Meyer Hatchery will ship as few as 3 baby chicks. Check them out online at MeyerHatchery.com. That's MeyerHatchery.com.
All righty. Chickens in the News, Jesse.
Yes.
Got any news items today?
I do, and I'm not sure if you were going to do this one, but I'm going to get it first.
Go
so
ahead.
There.
we don't
rehearse this thing. This is live radio. So, anyway, before I read this to you, you would probably know the correct pronunciation, and I don't want to make a mess of this. It is E-N-T-E-R-O-C-O-C-C-I. Interococci? Any idea, Pat?
Is it? I'm sorry, what is it again? You said P-N?
No, it's E-N.
Enterococci. Enterococcus. Yeah.
Okay. What is that? Enterococcus?
Yes.
What is
Enterococcus.
That?
It's a bacterium.
Okay.
It's
got the cocci name on it, which makes me think of like a cocci or something.
Like a cuckoo.
No, like a coccidiosis, like a cocci. Is it something like that? But
yes. It affects the intestinal tract.
Gotcha. Okay, this comes to us, Pat, from worldpoultry.net, and I'm sure this one is going to make you raise an eyebrow if you haven't read it yet. Study, organic poultry have fewer drug-resistant bacteria. Once again, the title is organic poultry have fewer drug-resistant bacteria. Mm-hmm. Poultry farms have adopted organic practices and ceased using antibiotics has significantly lowered levels of drug-resistant enterococci bacteria. Bacteria that can potentially spread to humans, according to a new study by the University of Maryland. The study, published with Environmental Health Perspectives, is the first to demonstrate lower levels of drug-resistance bacteria on newly organic farms in the United States, suggests that removing antibiotic use from large-scale U.S. poultry farms can result in immediate and significant reductions in antibiotic resistance for some bacteria. What do you think of that?
Well, it makes sense.
When
you take away the antibacterials. Oh, go ahead, Jesse. Mm-hmm. I'm cutting in on you.
Oh, no. I was kind of looking for your input before I went any further. So go ahead. When you take away, you were saying?
Well, when you give any being an antibiotic, anti meaning against and biotic life, antibiotic, it's indiscriminate. It kills out the good, the bad, and the ugly. That's why I think you have to give the probiotics to follow the antibiotics. Pro is for and biotic life. So it makes sense that if they get used to certain antibiotics, if there's drug resistance to the bad ones that we have going, they're going to live while the good ones get wiped out. So that's why they're probably seeing an immediate decrease in the bad bacteria. They don't because they're not using the antibiotics.
Right, but it's almost like instant, immediate. You know, it's great. But Pat, it goes on to say organic poultry resistance. And Pat, I need you to look in the chat room for a second. I'm going to type in something. I'm going to need you to pronounce for me in a second. It said while all farms tested positive for the presence of enterococci in the poultry litter, feed, and water as expected, the newly organic farms were characterized by significantly lower prevalence of antibiotic resistant enterococci. For example, 67% of, what is that word? Enterococcus faecalis?
Oh, that's good enough. Faecium? Faecium.
Yeah. I typed it in the chat room, whatever the word is. Recovered from conventional poultry farms were resistant to erythromycin, while 18% of enterococcus faecalis from newly organic poultry farms were resistant to this antibiotic. So, you know, it basically goes on, just kind of reiterates the whole article, but saying that, you know, going organic is the way to go, and no surprise there, Pat.
No, none at all. The statistics I had, because this kind of hit the news in several different articles, but the statistics they gave that I got is that on conventional farms, the problem with the Enterococcus faecium was 84% on the factory farms.
Mm-hmm.
And when they switched to
Correct.
The newly organic farms, it dropped to 17%. So that's a huge drop.
It is.
And that they showed up even after the first flock organic.
Yeah. You know, the problem is, Pat, I mean, really, I think for me, and it's just my opinion, not that of the show or the host or anything else, but my opinion is that we're just cramming too many birds in too small an area. And when you do that, you're just inviting inviting disease, inviting sicknesses. I mean, seriously, there's nothing, no animal that is designed to be kept in huge numbers in small areas. It just doesn't work. So,
right.
if we could go to more of a free range, more of a backyard movement, which will never happen because I guess too many people live in the city. But, I mean, that's what happens, Pat, isn't it? In a nutshell, when you have too many animals living in too small an area, you're going to have problems and you're going to need to vaccinate them and treat them and antibiotic them with everything, correct?
Well, we're certainly seeing that with people as well as with rats. And, of course, then people get stressed. Stress can cause a lot of the diseases. I mean,
sure.
It just changes the whole sort of biochemical pathways when you're under a lot of stress, and it's and not in a good way. But the other thing that is happening too, Jesse, it's not just the factory farms. It says, this article that I had that's about this study, it says it makes sense that the percentage of bad bacteria drop down when you go organic. If you remember
mm-hmm.
the warnings about antibacterial soap that can lead to drug-resistant germs.
Yeah.
It says chickens in conventional farms, they're fed the antibiotics that kill off some germs but allow the strongest ones to survive. So, and then they just keep surviving and surviving generation after generation.
Mutated.
But what was really wonderful about this study, and that surprised the researchers, was the speed and the magnitude. I mean, it just plummeted, the magnitude of change when the farms moved to organic and more humane practices. So that's a really golden takeaway there. So,
right.
Yeah, good article.
Yes.
Good
article. So I figured you'd like that one. We have to have some, and birds or animals, whatever the thing, we have to have exposure to bacteria, otherwise we're going to be living in a bubble and we can't go out of it, so.
Well, that's right,
right,
Jesse, and I think we've become so germophobic that in reality, our bodies, do you realize that in your body, in my body, in everybody's body, there are three times more bacteria than there are cells, and they're all body cells, three times more.
Wow.
So we're really more bacteria-based than we are even cellular-based from our own tissues. And, of course, you want to have the right bacteria. That's the key. So
right.
When people say, oh, I'm afraid of germs or afraid of bacteria, they're really afraid of themselves. They just have to understand it, that we're part of the living matrix.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And, it's funny when you mention that. Our the way our food is prepared, or the way you go to a supermarket and buy something, it's absolutely immaculate. I did tour some of Europe back in the very early 80s, maybe like 81, 82, and the markets there, the open-air markets, they've got meat sitting
right.
out there in the sun, and,
mm-hmm.
They take it home, they eat it, they don't have a problem, but our immune systems wouldn't be able to digest it like they do out there because we've become so, I don't know, Pat, I guess used to or immune, or we're not immune, but lack of immunity, I guess, to any bacteria as well. I mean, what do you think of that? I mean, have you been to Europe or some of these other countries and seen their open-air markets?
Oh, my goodness. I worked in third-world countries for 15 years, Jesse.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was
always... how do they survive? Makes you
well,
wonder.
Well, they're used to it. And I my colleagues and counterparts were always amazing. It seems like I could eat about anything and not get sick when some of my other companions were just,
right.
out for the day. And but a lot of it has to do with your immune system and how much hydrochloric acid you can form from your stomach, because that's one of the very first defenses of some of these bacteria. And if you have a low hydrochloric acid, which happens as you get older, or if you're taking these proton pump inhibitors that keep you from acid reflux, well, that takes away that first line of defense, and so you're a little more open to some of the diseases. But it's all a web. It's all an interesting web.
That, do you remember the 80s, Pat? Did you have like a big poufon, a big hair 80s thing?
No, Jesse, I never had a poufon.
Tell the truth.
Even, no, or a beehive. No, not
oh,
my head,
my goodness.
Anyway.
Yes, anyways. Yeah, big hair in the 80s. Somebody was talking about the 80s. But anyways, I digress. Pat, do you have any more chickens than you?
I do. I've got one quick one. and then we'll go to a short commercial break. This one comes to us from East Cobb, and apparently it's by Laura Braddock. Laura Braddock, and there's an East Cobb, ma'am. That's the county, I guess it is. It's in Georgia. Campaigns to keep his backyard chickens. So this is a little bit different in that. What this one says is the resident, Joseph Pond, it's Mr. Pond that has been busted for his chickens. Joseph Pond has joined the growing legion, they use that word legion, of urban chicken advocates in Georgia. Of course, and we know Andy Schneider, the Chicken Whisperer, is down there in Georgia. It says he bought 8 baby chicks, he built a coop, and he grew his family flock to have fresh eggs for him, his family, and his friends. He says, my wife and daughter are both vegetarian, and they've been wanting to have fresh eggs for a very long time. But then the code enforcement guy showed up, right? And apparently the city requires 2 acres to keep a family flock of chickens. That's a bit much. And the coop, and it has to be 100 feet from the property line. And it says the birds can be kept only for pets or for eggs, but not for meat. But they're within the code on that. So the ponds only have about a little less than half an acre, but he doesn't see that as a problem, quite frankly, neither do I. He says there's no state recommendation on how much room you need for chickens. Mine have at least 10 square feet, whereas commercially raised chickens, that's 10 square feet per chicken, he says, whereas most commercially raised chickens only have 67 square inches. So they've got a lot of room to stretch and scratch and take dust baths and that sort of thing. He knew that his lot didn't fit the minimum when he bought the chicks, but he researched the 2009 Georgia Landowner Protection Act and its previous protection of chicken owners, so he thought he was legal under the state, the 2009 State Landowner Protection Act. And that law convinced a nearby city to rewrite its ordinances, so he thought he was home free, but apparently not. So it's now his mission to get that ordinance changed for not only for himself, but for other chicken fans. And he says, there's a bunch of us. There are so many of us underground, and we don't want to be outed, but we do think the ordinances is inappropriate. So his site is backyardchicks.org. backyardchicks.org, and it's had over 700 visits already, and he's collected more than 200 visitors. He insists that the chicken movement, the backyard chicken movement, is more than a passing trend. It's all about people getting back to basics, and indeed it is. So what do you think about that, Jesse?
Well, I know I've been up to East Cobb. It's actually north of Atlanta, northeast of Atlanta, I think. But That's a rough area. Somebody in the chat room was saying, I guess they might be from that area, that they're really rough up there, basically, is what they're saying. But, good for him. I mean, you got to start somewhere. You know, it's just I live in the country because I don't know, Pat, about somebody telling me what color I can paint my house and what I can have. And, you know, if my grass is too long, I get in trouble. That's why we live out where we are. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's a good reason. Well, listen, Jesse, it's time for just a brief commercial break.
Yep.
And when we come back, we'll welcome Richard Frudenberger. He's the publisher and technical writer for Back Home Magazine, and we'll be talking about putting fish by. So hold on.
Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, pens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com. Or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing. Ordered your new baby chicks and even have the brooder prepared, but now it's time to order that new chicken coop. My Amish Goods offers quality built chicken coops for every size flock and budget. They have many styles and colors to choose from and will ship them fully assembled right to your front door. Act now and receive a special upgrade at no additional charge. Visit them online at myamishgoods.com. That's myamishgoods.com. Looking for something? Find it online at Bidbird Auctions. BidBird.com is an online auction service that caters specifically to the poultry, waterfowl, game bird, and pigeon hobbyists. With so many rare and exciting species listed daily and in a wide variety of categories, you'll want to visit often. Join hundreds of the nation's top breeders that have made BidBird auctions their new home. And get sold on BidBird.
Actually, in reality, I am Super Chicken.
Oh, yeah! Okay. Welcome back to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. It is now time to welcome our very special guest. He comes on routinely twice a month with from Back Home Magazine. Richard Frudenberger is the publisher and the technical writer. And Richard, you're live on the air with the Chicken Whisperer Talk Show. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Okay, good deal. I'm glad to be here.
Great, great. How's everything down there in North Carolina? You guys,
it's been hot, and it's been real hot, and it's cool now, cooler now, but it's certainly not cool. It's been brutally hot, and it's made for difficult times. You can't leave anything in the car; it gets burned up and all that stuff. But yeah, we're coming out of that now. So.
Oh well, good. Yeah, it has been here too. Are you dry? Are you hot and dry? Because you guys are usually hot and humid.
We have not had a whole lot of rain. No, I mean there's been some rain, but the air is pretty dry. It's unusually dry, actually. The humidity's been pretty low, so that's good if you need to dry things out or do some painting or something like that. So I think that's good.
Richard, you were cutting out on us just a little bit. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Yeah.
Okay,
Yeah, I can hear him fine, too.
Okay,
so,
great.
But, yeah, Richard, I know what you're going through because we just had, a whole week of just rain every day, it seems like, from morning to evening. So it's nice for things to dry up so you can get some work done. But
yeah, no, it's fine, and it's nice to have, a little relief from the mold and things, places like the garden shed or whatever, where you might be tucked away in the woods, and you get a lot of moisture on tools and things that you don't really want.
Yeah.
To be cleaning that stuff up all the time. So it's good to get some air going and some dry air too.
Richard, I have a quick question for you. When it's so dry like it is now, I mean, things are just crispy dry. Does it hurt to mow when it's so dry? Does that do anything to the fodder or to the grass?
Oh, I really don't know enough about the pasture grass to answer that, but I do know just regular lawns and standard Kentucky 31 and maybe the smaller, shorter varieties, the red top and whatever. But I usually set the blades up higher. Like you always do that in the beginning of the season because you don't want the sun to burn. It's very tender. The roots and the lower parts of the blades are very tender in the early part of the year in the beginning of the mowing season. And so you should set your mower blades, your deck height, a little higher for that. But I would... now it's in August, and normally in a normal condition, I would be, well into July, I'd lower that deck down a little bit and cut a little closer to the ground. But in these conditions, I just was cutting the other day, and I pulled it back up again, about 3 inches, no less than 3 inches for where I was cutting, because I just didn't really want to expose the, those roots to the the roots shouldn't. By now, the roots shouldn't be a problem, but just the blades of grass can really get damaging heat. I'm just wondering about UV rays and the heat itself. I mean, we had temperatures of over 100 degrees. That's really rare here, anyway. We're not right where I live. It was almost that, but I mean, not very far from here. There were recorded temperatures of over 100, which doesn't sound like much, probably in Alabama or Georgia, but it's for here in the mountains, it's a very unusual thing. So, and when you get up in those levels, it doesn't take much to make a difference. You know, it just takes a little bit over to kick it over the edge to be a problem. You know, so
right.
So yeah, I keep the mower deck higher than normal when it gets too dry, because I think it probably protects you know, just the extra length protects the soil better and protects the roots and such like that.
Okay. Well, thank you. I just wondered what I
Texas?
Should mow a field or not.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Jesse.
I'm sorry. No, I was just going to say, can you imagine Texas? They had a couple of weeks of 110, 111, 115 in some areas of Texas here just back recently. My goodness. So, yeah, we're thinking 100 pot. Imagine 110 plus.
Yeah, well, our circulation director, she has relatives in Texas, and she went back home for a couple of weeks, just got back yesterday, and she said it was just unbelievably brutal. And this is somebody who's, you know, used to that heat. She was talking about not being able to leave soda cans in the car with the windows shut because they would explode, and that happened.
Oh,
I mean,
my!
It wasn't just an urban legend. This was like, give me a wet rag and some detergent because I got to clean the inside of my car.
Oh my god!
You know, toothpaste melting and paint, you know, paint oozing, opening, you know, lids off with paint cans, just stuff like that. Just the heat. When you get up in 112 degrees and more, and you have a close, you know, especially in a closed car, you're talking about oven level temperatures. Then, I mean, I'm sure you're really going to boil. And if you lock your car in a city environment where you're going to lock your car and keep the windows up, I'm sure it gets, you know, very, very hot in there. So, you know, it's the kind of thing you cannot leave anything in the vehicle.
Yeah. Wow.
Right.
That's hard to comprehend.
Especially your groceries and fish.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like what we're going to talk about today. Maybe a little bit of pre-cooking before you put your meat up. That might be the answer right there.
Yeah.
Great.
Smoke your bullet by using your car in Texas. There you go. But yeah, I'm looking forward to your topic today. I've been sitting here. I've been in the pins and needles. Kind of. I'd like to hear about it. So.
Yeah, we're going to. Just talk a little bit about fish. I mean, I realized when I was thinking about the different techniques and such that this also applies, in at least the same techniques do, to just about, well, anything. You know, there's several techniques involved here, and there's a variety of meats that can get put up. But what I'm gonna talk about now is fish, because it's, you know, it's a good fishing season, a good time to be fishing now, and a lot of times people want to preserve their catch. You know, for future, you know, obviously for eating later on in the season when you may not have fish, or you might have a party or a get together or something, and you can't really, you know, you can't really get everybody together in time. Say if you had a good catch and you thought, well, maybe I'll, you know, invite a bunch of people over and maybe everybody can't come or whatever. So you might want to end up putting some fish up. So you know, we've got the traditional method. I mean, basically. You get a lot of fish. You know, these days the easiest thing to do is just to freeze them, and that's not a bad choice. But there are some more traditional methods as well, and I'll go over all of them. But we're talking about things like you know, potentially pickling the fish, vacuum drying them, salting them, canning them, pressure canning. You know, all this kind of stuff, and that's why I said. A lot of other foods and preserves can be treated in the same way or same technique with different temperatures, but we'll just talk about the fish. People don't usually think about meats as much. You know, talk about canning or preserves like that. We don't always think about meats like fish, but fish is an excellent candidate for storage, because number one, it needs to be stored. I mean, you need to deal with it quickly and correctly, and then you'll have it down the road edible and safely preserved, and you know, the other thing is you know fish isn't always available out of season, or it's expensive out of season, and when you catch it, you've caught it. It doesn't keep as well as apples or potatoes or something. So, you know, we've got a basic situation. So you know, the other thing is just in preserving foods in general, some of these other techniques. For those among us who are thinking about just, you know, the future of energy, we just had here in our local, our utility here, our area utility has just received a fairly hefty rate increase. Yeah. And basically somehow convolutedly, I shouldn't say blaming it on, it sounded this way, but due to the fact that they're using biofuels to power some of the smaller generators, apparently that somehow has affected their rate charges. So of course, instead of just absorbing them like any other company would, they just pass it on to the to the ratepayers. So that's what's great about a public utility, right? So so the shareholders get to keep the gravy, and the rest of us get to pay for it. But anyway, the cost of electricity is going up, in my neck of the woods, the reliability is going down. I mean, we have seen more frequent incidences of power outages. Maybe some not so long, although there have been some very long outages. I'm in my area, 3 to 5 days is not terribly uncommon. That happens sometimes. Of course, I don't live in town, so they don't really treat us like an urban area. I mean, they don't do us first. We're sort of the end of the line. But even the minor outages can be 10-12 hours, and that's inconvenient to say the least. But when you start getting the longer ones, then you do start affecting all that frozen stuff. I mean, you're talking in many cases hundreds of dollars worth of frozen meats and fish and other things. So we'll talk about freezing, but then we realize that some of the other methods are actually good because they will allow us to put up food and meats for long-term storage without having to worry about freezing or electricity or any of that stuff. So it's a good preparedness, safety and preparedness move. Maybe pickling or salting or vacuum packing or something like that, be able to keep your fish at least maybe not for years and years, but I mean for a longer period, away from all the worries about is my power going to go out in November when the hurricane season finally winds up and slams us at the very end of the season or something like that, or the snowstorms of January and February and March. And we tend in the mountains here, we tend to have our worst, heaviest snows in March and April for some reason. So certainly have our in December and January, but the bad storms usually come in March and even early April. So, that's a long time to wait and worry about electricity. So you put your food up in ways that don't require electricity and don't depend on it, and you've got a good situation there. You've sort of thought around the potential problems that could be going on down the road. So let's talk about freezing first, because that's probably what most people are going to start with. I mean, it's a good thing to start with, it's really not that difficult at all. It's the most popular thing. As long as you keep the meat in a freezer that's below 0 degrees Fahrenheit, you're going to be in safe area. You're going to be able to keep it for quite a while at that temperature, as long as it stays at that temperature. And some of the other things to think about are just the preparation prior to freezing the fish, and just how to deal with it. There's a couple different ways of preventing freezer burn, and there's a couple different ways of prepping the catch so it doesn't it starts its freezing process correctly. And the main thing there is if you're out on the pond or river or whatever, and you've got an abundant catch, the best thing to do is really keep the fish alive if you can't. Keep them on the line. You want to keep them from bruising. You want to if you can keep them alive, that would be keep them on stringers. That would really be a good thing, because then you don't have to worry about. You can prep them later not in the field. You can be home and doing it in a better environment. But if you don't have that option, you could also just bring along an ice cooler, a cooler with some ice in it, and at least you can keep them cool. And carefully put them in the put the fish in the cooler. Don't slam them around, because they once you bruise the meat, it tends to spoil a little. Well, it tends to spoil much more easily once it's been bruised. So if you
Oh really? Why is that, Richard?
Yeah. I really don't know, but it's assuming like it's a person. I mean, if you get hit, you know, if you hit bang your flesh or you get hit or something, you got a lot of blood to the surface. That's it's a tender spot, and once it's tender, it's probably open to deterioration with blood in it a lot more so than if it was the blood was down, you know, subcutaneous down below the skin. So that's just my opinion. I don't know, but somebody may have a better explanation. But I don't think it's a great idea to be slamming the fish around anyway. I mean, it's food. You can treat it, layer it in nicely, and pack it gently, and you'd be in better shape. So the whole idea here is to prep the frozen meat in something that you can store without having to worry about. You want to be able to label it, and you want to be able to keep it reasonably protected from banging around the freezer, even though it's frozen. You want to lose it. You want to be able to mark it and stuff. So you can get either the real heavy duty freezer bags, which is probably the least expensive option, and they also make plastic freezer boxes.
Richard, there's a comment in the chat room. It says that the big salmon fishermen, this is from Critter Lover, are very careful, very, very careful not to bruise the fish because it lessens their value. And then another comment says if it's bruised, it will freezer burn faster. I didn't know that either.
Sense. Yeah, I didn't know that myself. Yeah. That makes sense. And also, I wasn't thinking of a commercial value of a salmon, but when you're talking about a fish that's $13 a pound or whatever it is, certainly the visual aesthetic appeal of your buy is going to be much more enhanced with a good, clean-looking fish than one that's all beat up. So, he's absolutely right. So the ideal thing is to get your freezer box if you can, or the heavy-duty plastic freezer bags. But you can also use just plastic wrap if you wrap it enough, or you can use freezer paper. That's another thing people don't always think about these days, but there is a freezer paper available that's sort of a heavy white it's not really waxy, but it sort of has the one side sort of sometimes has that feel to it. You basically want to try to freeze them in small units. In other words, you don't want to stack them all up in a big lump and wrap it up like a shoebox and stick it in there. You want to try to set them in individual packets and wrap them up as individuals so you can do your freezing in a single layer, basically. But another way to do it, and I want to mention it before I forget about it, is that you can actually freeze the fish in water. You can prepare your fish. Place a single layer, just a single layer of fish, in a shallow pan, and just cover it just over the surface with water, and then take the whole thing and stick it in the freezer. And so obviously you have to have room. You have to have room in the freezer, or if most game people, most fishermen, avid fishermen or avid game people have chest freezers anyway. They have chest freezers. They have extra freezers. They have room to put their catch. So if you don't, you're just going to have to make room. But take a shallow pan, put the water in it, and just freeze freeze the whole thing. The water, because the water, once the water is frozen, it actually is a great protector of the meat against freezer burn. And once it's it's like snow being insulation. Once it's surrounded the fish and frozen, it's pretty hard to hurt it. And then once you've done that, you can wrap the whole shooting mesh, the whole thing in freezer paper, or wrap it the way you would choose, and then obviously label it, and date it and identify it and whatever, and then put it back in the freezer. And a little variation on that, you can also just freeze.
Richard, before you go on that variation, just a second, but the chat room's really engaged in your talk here today. They're saying that some people freeze it in bags of salt water in the freezer, and then others are saying that don't use freezer paper because it has a plastic coating? I hadn't
heard
that before.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, I just when I said freezer paper, the old stuff, I mean, I don't know if
it's... I think of the old stuff. It's wax paper.
No, not wax paper. It's the older freezer paper that I used to be able to get, and I really, now that I'm thinking about it, or before when I was thinking about it, I really haven't seen it in a while. It doesn't have the wax. It's a heavy, it's not a craft paper. It's a white paper, and it's a heavy, it's a heavier paper, and it doesn't really, it may have some wax in it, but it's not really obvious. The newer paper that I've seen is a little thinner, but it has one side that has a definitely waxy finish to it, and I think that's what they're talking about. So if that would be a problem, I would avoid that, you know, that paper. But you probably should be able to find a freezer paper that doesn't have a waxy coat on it. Although they need something, you would need something in the freezer paper to keep moisture from penetrating. So I think in the older style, maybe they just somehow impregnated the paper with a very thin bed of, I don't know, not a bed, but a thin, I don't know what it would be, not so much a layer, but just a bit of waxy material, whereas in new style, they just sort of cover one whole side of the paper with it, and that's probably not what you want, obviously.
Okay. Well, what about the tin foil to use as a wrap?
I think that's a invitation to freezer burn, myself.
Yeah.
I don't think it provides the padding or the protection, and plus it transfers the temperature to, you know, it's touching the skin. It may actually burn through the scales. Yeah.
Plus the aluminum might be absorbed onto some of the fish for that. And then the other question here is vacuum bagging. I know our poultry farm, we would just use a regular vacuum cleaner, just turn it on, it sucks all the air out, gave a very nice tight packaging and kept the water crystals down. But
yeah, that's
exactly.
Yeah, that's the other method I was going to mention beyond the straight freezing. You can also freeze before I get off the freezing. You can also freeze your fish without the water. You can actually lay it on a plate or in a pan. Again, a pan would sort of take up more room, but you can lay it on a plate or a paper plate or a dish or whatever. Just lay it down and put it in the freezer as is, and once it's frozen solid, then you can wrap it in paper or whatever you choose, and then label it and such. So that's another way. But I sort of like the idea of the water, and even the salt water, the brine water is another option too. That makes even more sense. So that's, you know, all that is good. But again, unless you have a generator, or unless you're absolutely positive that you're not going to have problems with power outages, or if you have a big family or a lot of buddies, if the power does go out, you can eat everything real quick. You know, I would, you know, think twice about freezing. Although you could sort of hedge your bet. I mean, you could freeze some, you could vacuum pack some, and you could salt some, maybe, something like that. So, because all the, you know, it's sort of fun to sort of do this kind of harvest prep in a traditional way. But back to the bagging. That's a whole other option. I think more and more people, and then, you know, with game meats, that's what a lot of people do. There are machines called like the Food Saver and other clones of Food Saver machines. They're little. Well, some of them are actually bigger, but I actually have a little one. I bought it at a yard sale for like $5 or something. It comes a special bag with their special vacuum, like a roll of bags, and they heat seal, and then the machine, clamps the. It clamps and heat seals the edges so it's, you know, really sealed. And then there's a little vacuum, you know, pump thing that you, like you said, you just draw all the air out of the bag and then seal it. And, you know, the whole kit. I mean, I've seen them on eBay, and, you know, I never looked into the really expensive ones, but I mean, some of the cheaper ones, I mean, they're probably $60-$70 and, you know, brand new with all the supplies you need, and then go up from there. But you know, that's a real popular option. Everything's all ready for you. You do it and you label it, and it's all done. If you do it when the fish are fresh, then it really maintains the freshness. You can store them. You can prolong the freshness you know, for quite a while, and you have, and you also have the bonus of having the vacuum bags you can see through. You know, the one side's clear, so you're right on the other side, and then on the clear side, you actually see the, you know, see what you've done, what your date is, what your fish is, and then you pop it in the freezer like that, and so it's not only labeled and packaged correctly, but it's also vacuum sealed. And of course, you still have to put it in the freezer. I mean, you can't just leave it out like that. I mean, you're really just drawing out microbes and air that will inhibit or will contribute to spoilers. So once you remove the air from the bag, you're really inhibiting spoilers. So, you know, it's a good tight method and really relatively inexpensive with one of those machines. So that's sort of the gold standard for the freezer method anyway. You know,
uh-huh.
good deal.
Great.
And you can get those
Richard,
bags. You know, oh, go ahead.
You can keep those bags for a long time, huh?
Well, you can also, I was going to say, they come in different widths. So you can, you know, the small ones are really maybe 6 inches or so, and then you can get machines and bags with much wider, you know, size. So you can put, you know, 12, 11 and a half or 12 inches, something like that. You can put bigger hunks in there.
Great. Okay. Well, it's time just for a short commercial break, Richard. And then when we come back, we'll continue on with putting fish by. And are there any differences with the different kinds of fish, the way you handle them? I mean, I don't know. That's just a question that kind of came up. But we'll be right back after a short commercial break, where our special guest today is Richard Frudenberger. He is the publisher and technical writer for Back Home Magazine. And we're talking about putting fish by, or putting fish up after you catch all those great fish tails. Stay tuned, folks.
EggCartons.com, your discount supplier of egg cartons and poultry supplies. They carry a wide variety of egg cartons in paper, plastic, and foam, as well as a great selection of poultry supplies, including incubators, brooders, waterers, feeders, and more. Order online at EggCartons.com or call toll-free 1-888-852-5340. Free full-color catalog available. Be sure to sign up for their online newsletter for more great specials. That's eggcartons.com. Pictures of chickens on aprons are common across America, but picture a chicken wearing an apron and you'll probably get a good chuckle. Laugh if you must, but nothing protects hens better than the Hen Saver Hen Apron. Hen Saver Hen Aprons protect your hens from the damage caused by an overly affectionate rooster and may even provide protection from an unexpected hawk attack. Hen Savers come in several different sizes to fit both bantam and standard-sized hens and roosters. Colors include camo, denim, navy, brown, khaki or black, and soon pink. Crazy K Farm is expanding its already colorful Hen Saver collection to include the color pink. A portion of their sales will be donated to organizations that fund breast cancer research and awareness. Order your Hen Saver aprons today at hensaver.com. That's hensaver.com.
Ladies, do you have a hard time finding the perfect gift for that animal lover on your list? I did, but not anymore. I shop at HobbyHillFarm.com. They have a great selection of dog, cat, horse, and chicken gifts that are not only cute, but affordable too. Check them out at HobbyHillFarm.com and become a Facebook fan at Facebook.com/HobbyHillFarm to receive updates on new products and special discounts. I just know you're going to love HobbyHillFarm.com. I do.
Ideal Poultry has been a family-owned and operated business since 1937. Their business is built on customer service and quality poultry. From rare white and brown egg layers to broilers, ducks, turkeys, and bantams, Ideal Poultry is the largest supplier of backyard poultry in the United States, shipping close to 5 million chicks annually. Visit them online at idealpoultry.com. That's idealpoultry.com.
Mount Healthy Hatcheries has been a hatching tradition for over 80 years. Home of the healthiest chicks, Mount Healthy Hatcheries offers a wide selection of bantams, turkeys, guineas, ducks, pheasants, and of course, meat birds and layers. Order online at mounthealthy.com. That's mthealthy.com, or give them a call at 1-800-451-5603. Don't forget to ask about their free bonus chicks offer. Mount Healthy Hatcheries, home of the healthiest chicks.
Looking for something? Find it online at Bidbird Auctions. Bidbird.com is an online auction service that caters specifically to the poultry, waterfowl, game bird, and pigeon hobbyists. With so many rare and exciting species listed daily and in a wide variety of categories, you'll want to visit often. Join hundreds of the nation's top breeders that have made Bidbird Auctions their new home. And get sold on Bidbird.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
All righty. Welcome back to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, Backyard Poultry and Sustainable Lifestyles Talk Show. Our special guest today is Richard Frudenberger. He's publisher and technical writer for Back Home Magazine. And Jesse Paul is our very special guest co-host. And Richard, why don't you tell us how to connect with Back Home Magazine? I'm going to post all this in the chat room, but for our listening audience, what's the best way they can subscribe?
Okay, we got the website, of course. It's www.backhomemagazine.com. That's the easiest way to just get online, and we have all the ordering information for subscriptions, books, building plans, products, and back issues, and our library, our bookstore, has over 100 titles in all the areas you'd want, you know, home building, green building, renewable mm-hmm. energy, putting up food like we're talking about now. We got 3 or 4 titles on that. So if you don't want to use the internet and you actually want to talk to a real live person who's an actual employee and staff member and part owner of the magazine, you can dial 800-992-2546, and that's your toll-free number to connect directly to the office, and we can help you with a subscription or anything else you might need. So those are the best ways to get a hold of us, and our address and everything is online. If you need to write a letter, we get letters every day, so certainly use the snail mail as well, so no problem there.
Oh, great. And I must say, it's true, you get a live person when you call every single time. And it is an owner-operated publishing company, owner-operated magazine. It's the people that own it actually put it out. So, and the other thing, of course, this was the original staff of the Mother Earth News magazine before they moved north, as I understand. So, okay, Jesse, you said you had a special tip to talk about putting food by.
Richard, you kind of talked very briefly about power outages and everything else. You know, especially this time of the year, if we have any, a half empty freezer, we will fill that up with bagged water or containers that turn to ice. When the power does go out, we don't lose we don't lose all of our food in there. It'll keep for well over a day, maybe even up to 48 hours, provided you don't open that freezer up, and to keep all your food in there. Have you ever heard of doing that, Richard?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I had completely forgotten about that. But number one, that's obviously a way to extend the coldness in the freezer. But number two, and many people may not realize, both in a freezer and in a refrigerator, the fuller it is, as long as there's circulation around the edges, you know, around the walls, the fuller the box is with food or anything, really, it could be bottles of water or food or whatever, the more effectively the machine operates. It just works that way. The too much air inside the box of the refrigerator drops the efficiency of the system. So it's always good to put something in there. And if you don't have food to put in there, it sure helps to put in, like you said, bottles of water, or you know, in the freezer you put in frozen containers, so you have that ice helping to keep things going if you do lose the power. That's a real good point.
Right. Well, thank you for touching on that.
Well, it saves electricity too, because it has to run less once it's cold.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. But you know, all the refrigerator does is not, well, I shouldn't say all it does, but the, one of the major jobs of the refrigerator is to just remove water from the air in the box, because that's how things get cold, is by lowering humidity. That makes it easier on the compressor. So one of the major jobs of the refrigerator is to keep the air in there at a lower humidity, and that's why the controls on the vegetable drawers, you'll notice you have a little sliding or a wheel maybe, or a sliding tab that says, you know, crisper right and left, you know, dry or you know, crisp and fresh. Well, all that's doing is controlling the amount of when those openings are shut. That box, that little box, little drawer is going to be more moist than the rest of the box. When that thing's open, the box is going to suck the moisture out of that drawer more effectively. So by adjusting that sliding tab, you're actually controlling the humidity within the little drawer. So that's you know, some foods like lettuce maybe want a little humidity, and some would rather not have the humidity. So you can sort of do some fine tuning in the way of long-term storage. Or I shouldn't say long-term, but short-term storage in your refrigerator, you know, for a week or so, by just minding your drawer tabs there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all this is in the instruction manual. You know, people, you know, strangely enough, people don't read the book. When they buy an $800 machine, and they don't read the owner's manual, and it's all in there.
Richard. You know, I've always said the owner manuals were, you know, I'm going to be in trouble for this. Owner manuals were for our wives. When we were installing these things, we would give her the wives. You know, anyway. Yeah.
Oh,
hey, don't judge me, yes, but that's what I wish that I thought.
Okay, Richard.
Okay, let's get on to
any more advice for
us. Yeah, let's talk about canning a little bit, because you know, I'm calling it canning, but it's really pressure canning. This is not hot bath canning. I'm talking about actually purchasing a new generation canner, you know, pressure cooker, you know, pressure canner. And you know, people think about the old style of grandma's canner, and you know, explosions and problems and all that. Well, the new ones have so many safety features on them. The old ones are pretty to look at. I mean, some of them are real pieces of art if you ever get to see some of the high end ones, but you know, they're best left on the shelf or on the display rack. You know, the newer ones, there are some excellent books on the subject. The canning companies publish some excellent books. When you buy a canner, they have either the company themselves or they have recommendations for other books. But basically, the modern equipment is so much safer and so much more effective than the older equipment that it's well worth, if you're seriously thinking about both preserving fish or anything else, it's well worth looking into the possibility of buying either a gas, you know, a stovetop canner or an electric. They actually make electric, you know, plug-in styles too. So anyway, once we've established that, we're talking about, you know, pressure canning these fish, and for this kind of preservation, you want to clean the fish completely and break it down into small chunks. You're taking off the head, the entrails, the fins, the scales, the tail. You know, you're basically, and maybe even the skin. You're basically taking the fish down to the meat, washing the meat, and then cutting the meat into small pieces. Now the reason for that is that smaller pieces fit better in the jar, and the heat distributes better in the jar if the pieces are smaller, because that allows the heat to get to every single piece. So, and even in some people are of the opinion that they don't even want to store in the quart jars, because they're too big. The heat penetrates slower in the bigger jar. So you can break it down into smaller pint jars and just use more of them, you know, for the same amount of meat. So that will allow the heat to penetrate quicker and more effectively in the smaller container. So basically, you cut your meat into strips that are just shy of the lid, maybe an inch shy or inch or so shy of the height of the jar itself. So so you have a little headspace there, and the liquid, you can come up to the top there, and basically the other thing I really need to make clear is that there are very specific instructions for different types of machines and also in different types of foods. So if you have experience in pressure canning tomatoes or something, I would not recommend applying that to the fish because it's, totally different. Different foods have different requirements. The books, as I said, the books that come with the canners that are recommended by the manufacturers are excellent sources. I've got a Blue Ball book myself, real good source of, there's a couple different versions of them, but, real good source on canning. There's a few other excellent sources. The other thing is, we are in our area here, and I'm pretty sure others, we have a county extension agency. Our cooperative extension service has classes about once a month, if not more, on a lot of different things, on prepping, prepping foods, on canning, on putting up preserves, on just a whole bunch of different things. And you're more than likely to find some help from your extension agent, either through a class or through some instruction or maybe advice from an old timer or something. But I would try that, and I would try getting the book. But without going into a lot of detail, it takes a while. I mean, it takes an hour or more to prepare each batch of container. So you can fit, I don't know how many, it depends on the size of the jar, but you can fit maybe the larger jars really only fit a few jars in the container, but the pint jars you could put in probably six or eight of them. So you take an hour, maybe an hour and 20 minutes or so per batch of fish, and it does take some time, and it does take some prep time because you have to do all the entrails and the head and the scales and all that. But once you've got it, and once you've canned it, you don't have to, and if you've done it properly, under the temperatures we're talking about, you can produce a long-term storage batch, and you can keep it on the shelf for quite a while without having to worry about freezers and refrigeration. And you also have your options for some of the pickling and like the pickled herring and some of that other kind of more traditional fish that you can follow. There's always recipes and instructions for that kind of thing. So you always have that little extra value-added options there with the canning that is always nice to have. And it's also nice to see, it's sort of very comforting to see a shelf full of canned goods on the shelf that you lined up 20 or 30 jars and they're all there and you can get to them, and if you have a problem with getting to the store or whatever, I mean whatever the problem might be, I mean Lord knows gasoline may be $15 a gallon next year, we don't know, so you may not be going to the store as frequently as you think, and also there may not, as we talked about before, grocery stores only have about a 2 or 3 day supply. Fuel costs money, and fuel gets very expensive. You don't know if they're going to be stocking the shelves as thoroughly as they always do. So, it's always nice to put up food. So canning is the one option. The other thing is smoked fish. And this is it's another, another option that people don't always think about, but, there's two different ways. There's an old traditional method, and there's a more modern method where you really don't need to cure the fish as long, and you don't need to smoke the fish as thoroughly. The downside of that is that you still need to refrigerate it or freeze it because your smoking it's not to the level of heavy smoking that will preserve the fish without it being cold. So, but you still have the nice taste of and texture of the smoked fish, which is always nice. And if you like smoked fish, it's a nice combination of having partial curing and partial smoking, and then you can still use the cooler to keep the fish safe. To smoke it, you really just need to get a little home smoker. I've seen it for $15-$17 in box stores and hardware stores, the little ones. They're very small. If you want to just do an individual prep for a single person, if you need more, more volume, you can buy a larger smoker, which obviously is more expensive. But even those are not much more than $100 in some of the home improvement stores. I've seen them in the summer, and you can go online, and I've seen some really nice plans for making out of 55 gallon drums and old water heater tanks. People have made some really nice smoking chambers. The other thing is, I was looking at an article at some point. We did not publish it, but I was looking at it. It was a using old refrigerators, using old refrigerator boxes with the compressors removed and the shelves in place, but the compressors removed, and just using setting that up as a smoking chamber. Actually, it works quite nicely because everything you need is right there. I mean, it's insulated, it's safe, it doesn't have the Freon anymore in it, you know, so you're in good shape. And if you really want to, and we still have people around here that still use them, smoke houses. People have restored old smoke houses, and I've seen people actually build new smoke houses just to be able to smoke their pork products be able to put up that in the fall, put up that harvested meat, smoke it, and be able to store it without having to worry about freezing everything. And it's sort of a tradition and sort of a family thing or a neighborhood get together. I mean, in the rural parts of the county, people, you know, still put their smokehouses to use. And of course, in those days, people had outside kitchens too. I mean, they had their summer kitchen and their winter kitchen. You could not cook in the summer in the house because it would just heat. You know, the whole house would be an oven. So they actually had an outdoor kitchen that they used in the summer, and then the indoor kitchen would be used in the winter. But anyway, smoking is another option. And again, this is something. There are some excellent books on smoking game and other meats. The extension agent is another great source of times and temperatures for this kind of thing. But the basic process with the fish is that you need to brine the meat before you start the process, which simply just using some pickling salt, maybe 1.5 cups of salt to a gallon of water, and just soak the fish in that to give it just a brine, a brine coating or a brine soaking. And then you can smoke it. Now there's two techniques to smoking. The cold smoke process is basically smoke at temperature. The temperatures do not exceed 110 degrees Fahrenheit. Maybe at the high end, about 70 or 65 at the low end. That's one process of a cooler smoke. Obviously, that takes a while. It takes a day, a full 24 hours, if not more, because the heat isn't there to really dry out the meat as well. And then there's the more traditional hot smoke fish, which takes less time. It'll bring the temperature up to about 175 degrees or so, and you can cut your time down to, again, I don't really, you know, it really depends on what kind of fish, you know, the thickness of the meat, the kind of fish it is, and then of course the kind of meat it is if you're smoking other meats. But that's a less more intense heat with a shorter time frame. So there's those two options, and as I said, the extension agent or a good book will be able to detail those with the specific types of meats you're going to be, you know, be talking about. Smoking is a real traditional method, but then we also have even a more traditional method, and this goes back to, you know, the cod days and well before that, how they used to keep fish when, you know, expeditions would go out and, you know, catch cod by the ton when it was still a very, very cheap commodity. And, you know, years ago it was just a nothing fish. I mean, people just, everything had, you know, every meal you had cod because it was like, a nickel a pound or something. This is salting. You know, salt drying, and you normally fillet the fish. You can do it whole, but you normally would fillet the fish, and you should scale the fish as well, take off the head, the bone structure, remove the backbone or whatever. But you have your fillets left over, and you need to clean it, you know, brush scrub it, and just again soak it in a brine solution for about half an hour. And that's about, you know, that's sort of a weaker solution. One cup of salt, pickling salt is good. One cup of salt to 1 gallon of water. Just soak the fillet in there for about 30 minutes, half an hour or so. It'll firm up the flesh a little bit. The salt sucks the moisture, the embedded moisture, out, so it starts the process. And then what you want to do is lay these things out on trays and just coat each slab, each fillet with a very generous helping of a fine pickling salt, which you'll need about probably about 1 pound of salt does about 4 pounds of fish. So you really want to cover all sides of the fish with a nice layer of pickling salt, because that will continue the process of bringing the moisture out of the meat. And at this point, here we get to the real traditional stuff: is you're going to dry it outside on racks. And it may take, I mean, it really may take a week. Obviously,
wow.
You
okay.
You know, with us, in the old days, they probably didn't worry about it as much, but, you know, these days with our concerns about bacteria and whatever, I would you would not want to dry them out. You want to dry them on a warm day. Obviously, you want to dry them not in direct sunlight. You want to get a shaded area where they're not directly in the sun. And you also want to possibly cover them with, or unless you're going to be there to actually see it, cover them with some kind of cheesecloth or some, give them some screening or something, some tenting over them, a screening or cheesecloth to just prevent flies and any other curious insects, you know, yellow jackets,
yeah.
Actually getting on the meat. Not that, I mean, as I said, in the old days, it probably didn't make a huge difference. It was just part of life. But now we don't really want to think about that. So it doesn't hurt to get some screening or get some cheesecloth and just sort of make a little tent over them. But you don't want the fillets to touch. You want to keep them apart on the screen. And you know, you just let them sit there and just dry. If it's, you know, if it's raining, you have to take it in. At night, you have to take it in. If it rains, you have to take it in. Just move the whole thing indoors to a safe location and just continue the process again the next day when it, you know, if it's not raining, when it clears up again. And as I said, it can take, you know, it can take a good week to just get that, that meat, just moisture sucked out. That salt will just pull all that moisture out of the meat. And you will have to turn the, you know, turn the fish over, once a day at least and, you know, let the top side work and then let the other side work and you really don't want to expose them to dampness, moisture, rain. Even the evening damp is not desirable, so you want to take that whole rack in at night and just, you know, keep it protected and just let it work through the night and then take it out again in the morning and let it dry again naturally outside. Now the other another option here, and a lot of people do this, and the instructions are very clearly labeled, the Excalibur-type food dryers. Excalibur is certainly not the only manufacturer, but that's probably the most common one. There's at least, well, I've seen, I did some online shopping last year for one of these, several other units were popular as well, but basically an electric dryer that has a timer and temperature option on it are excellent sources of mechanical or artificial drying that actually is, you know, obviously going to be less trouble, less babysitting, probably safer as far as any bugs or anything getting on it because they just won't inside
right.
the house.
And Richard, we've just got 3 minutes left. It's just
a three-minute
warning. Okay. Yeah. So go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I'm pretty much wrapped it up, and we've got the electric plug-in dryers have full instructions for you know you can make jerky and that kind of thing, but there's also some instructions for thicker fillets. You know, times are longer with the thicker the meat. And the other option is, and I've seen some excellent design solar food dryers. And I know we've discussed it at some point before on the show here, but you know, some of the more I wouldn't even say sophisticated, but some of the ones that work better drying meat, at least the thinner slices of meat, fish meat, in a solar dryer is a very feasible operation. Again, these things, with the correct design, you automatically have screens built into them, and there's, you know, you have your racks and everything. It's in a chamber, so you don't have that worry about flies and other bacteria getting onto the, or other insect material getting onto the meat. So, you know, if you really want to do it in a natural way, you can still do it outdoors with the help of the sun in a solar food dryer, and you get the best of both worlds. You know, no electricity, no cost, and
nice,
other than the initial
nice.
Investment. So, I mean, that's
okay.
You know, that's it.
Well, that Richard, we've got to wrap it up with that. That's great information you've told us today about how to put food by and so many different ways to do it. Thank you so much for coming on. And Jesse, any final questions for Richard? That's be quick.
No, because I know we're running low on time. Just thanks for coming on, Richard. Always great to have you here, Pat. Thanks for having me back as a co-host, and maybe we'll see you tomorrow. And Pat.
Oh, my pleasure. Okay.
Yeah.
So,
okay,
Richard,
we'll see
again,
you
thanks. Our special guest today was Richard Freudenberger. He's from Back Home Magazine, the publisher and a technical writer. And a quick announcement, Chicken Whisperer tour continues. Andy will be in Columbia, South Carolina, on August 22nd, 23rd, and 24th for a Manipro event. So look out for that. Of course,
yep.
Thanks again so much to all our chat room chicken ears for being so very gabby there on the show today. That was really a great, great show. And, of course, Jesse, you've always been great. Thanks again. Mm-hmm. Our Blog Talk Radio provided the radio, chat, and the video services. And I'm Pat Flynn, and on behalf of us all, blessings to all. We love you all so much. God be with you evermore. God bless everybody. Thank you.